Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of June. As you look at the pictures of the flooded cornfields and flooded farm fields all over the Midwest, the question, of course, comes to mind, what in the world are these farmers going to do? And then what's going to happen to the price of food and to the price of fuel as a result of these enormous floods? Growing demand worldwide there is right now for food at a time when production has not kept up, which is forcing prices higher. And before the recent floods in our part of the country, the price of corn already had more than doubled over the past 2 years, and they have jumped another 25% in the past few weeks. The demand for corn and soybeans has been fueled by aggressive development of alternative fuels made from grains like ethanol and biodiesel. And the higher oil prices have also raised the cost of producing grains, so farmers now have to pay more for fertilizers and the diesel fuel needed to run their combines. What does all of this mean? We'll be talking the first hour of our program with two guests and welcoming you as well. I'm particularly interested in farmers who are living this the past few weeks as the floodwaters have just been huge. We have two guests with us, Professor Stephen Deller. He's a professor and community development economist in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and is joining us from our Madison studios today. Professor Deller, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also joining us is Professor Roger Elmore. He joins us from Iowa today. He's a professor and extension corn agronomist in the Department of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Professor Elmore, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome, and good morning.
Good morning to you. You know, I keep thinking about these farmers. You look at these fields, and the first thing that I'm thinking about before we talk about how it affects the consumer is so many of these people have lost all of their crops, and it seems as though many of them have lost them for most of the season. They are devastated, aren't they? Professor Deller?
Yes, they are. It is, particularly when you look across the Midwest, there are several parts of the Midwest that have just been devastated. This Iowa has been particularly hard hit. There are parts of Wisconsin, particularly southern Wisconsin, that have been very hard hit. There are other parts, though, that have actually gone through this quite well. Those farmers are actually going to be able to benefit from these higher prices.
Mm. Professor Elmore, what about in Iowa?
You're right. It is a pretty sad story over here. Perhaps up to 19-20% of our corn acres are at risk that have been either flooded or need replanting, and probably nearly 30% of our soybean acres are in that kind of category. So there's a lot of decisions need to be made here in the next few weeks as things dry out. It's not a great time.
No. What kinds of decisions are you talking about?
Well, you know, when a farmer looks at a field that's got 3 foot of water on it, the first thing you might think about is how to get that water off. And once it does dry up, and we've been blessed with several days now of good, warm, drying conditions, the things that go through a person's mind are is the crop salvageable?
Mm-hmm.
Have I lost it or not? And then questions about replant. If you replant, which crop do you plant? And then there's always a safety net of crop insurance that most Iowa farmers anyway do have access to.
Mm-hmm.
That is one thing we have seen in Wisconsin is an increasing number of farmers that are purchasing crop insurance. That's a positive trend. But one of the problems that we have in Wisconsin is that we're getting so late in the season that the options for replanting, particularly, it's going to take time for these fields to dry out. And we're so far into the planting season that there really aren't that many options left for a lot of these. Some of our agronomists here in the UW system are actually suggesting that we just let the fields go feral for a year.
Really? And can you get crop insurance if you're not in a floodplain if you're a farmer?
Yes, you can get crop insurance for all sorts of reasons. We could have a killer freeze, a late season killer freeze. There's all sorts of coverage that you can get for crops.
Professor Elmore explained this to me. Before the recent floods the last few weeks, corn prices already had more than doubled over the past 2 years. They have jumped another 25% in the past few weeks. What are the ramifications of that?
part of the ramifications are that people are really interested in producing corn this year, and that's why some of the old ideas about, you know, what is profitable in terms of the yield from a late planted crop, and are they willing to risk the associated fall frost? Those things, some of those things go out the window as you look at $5, $6, $7 corn. People are re-looking at those and are bringing up old numbers and the best simulations we have, trying to get yield estimates and risk of frost potentials on these late planted crops. So, Stephen is correct. Normally, we don't think about planting corn this late.
Right.
But people are because of the price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that's different about Wisconsin is that a lot of the fields that are being affected are crops that are being planted by dairy farmers, and they're planting these crops for feed for their livestock. And if these fields are beyond repair, given the time of the season that we're in, we're looking at a lot of dairy farmers that are going to be looking at very high feed prices, and they're going to be looking, trying to be creative in terms of how can they keep the nutrients of their feed up without necessarily relying on $7 or $8 corn or $15 soybean. There's going to be some real tough decisions that's going to be made in the next couple of months.
Well, what can they do? How can they feed their animals then?
That's a very good question. What they're probably going to end up doing is just having to absorb the cost in the short run.
Mm-hmm. How late can you plant corn?
That sounds like a question for me. when you get into Iowa, the data shows that if you could have planted in the middle part of June, you know, in the last few days, you might have gotten 60 to 70% yield potential. But what happens as we go into later June, yield potentials drop tremendously. So by the 30th of June, we're talking 50% or less yield on a given piece of ground. But the problem is the likelihood of frost on those crops goes up tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when Stephen mentioned silage and other forage uses of corn, and in Iowa at least, those would be good options if you have cattle yourself or you have neighbors that could use that feed. So the risk of getting corn for grain frosted on it is pretty high, but there would be a lot of silage value in planting corn. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many other forage alternatives as well.
And tell me, what percentage of farmers do you think in Iowa will choose to take the risk and plant again?
Boy, that's really a big unknown because they're balancing all these factors. Should I plant soybeans? Should I plant corn? What's the price going to be? What's the chance of frost? What kind of insurance program do I have?
Mm-hmm.
What's the previous crop I'm planting into? How long is it going to take before I can plant those fields? There are people probably replanting as we speak up on the higher ground. So there's so many options to think about, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is that we're still assessing the damage. I mean, in Dane County here, where Madison's located, a few days ago, there was an assessment that the crop lossage was $26 million.
Wow.
Well, that was followed up 2 days later with an assessment of $64 million. Mm. So we're still very much in kind of the assessment mode. And so much of the emergency management attention right now is really towards, many of the flooded towns. And the farmers, to be honest with you, a lot of them, the attention has not been drawn to them right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a little bit of time for the towns to dry out and for farmers to really get a better assessment of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how much of the land is devoted to ethanol and what all of this will be doing to the already astronomically high price of gasoline.
Well, we've already seen in Wisconsin, there was a ethanol plant that was proposed to be built, and it was on the drawing boards, and all the permits were acquired, and they were ready to break ground. And about 2 weeks ago, they decided that they weren't going to do it because the price was just simply too high.
Hmm.
I'd heard that there's a couple of plants in Iowa that have shut down because they simply cannot cost flow with the cost of corn this high. We're seeing the same thing with soybeans, with soy diesel. Although soy diesel isn't nearly as big as ethanol, we're simply seeing many of the smaller plants in particular, a lot of the plants that were built early on in this initial run-up on ethanol, they're just not cost-effective. There's tremendous economies of scale in these production plants, and the earlier plants simply cannot operate profitably at these kind of prices.
Mm-hmm. And Roger, what about the price of food? Where is it going?
Yeah, let me answer. Go back and sure. Think about ethanol for a minute. As I understand the shutdowns of plants, and I think there have been three plants in Iowa shut down, and as what I understand is all three of those active and working plants, 3 million gallons per year potential, were shut down because of floods.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were directly in the floodplains, and others simply had access to roads and bridges and railroads, and all those things have, you know, the eastern part of the state has been ravaged by these floods. And so the shutdowns are of active plants, as far as I know, were not due to the price of corn or anything. It's due to the floods.
Mm-hmm.
There are plants that were planned on being built that have not been built. And about 30% of our crop goes into ethanol, so it's a big driving force. It's a big use. You know, over half of the corn in the U.S. is used for feed for animals,
mm-hmm.
and about 8% or so is used for food. You know, and you talk about cornstarch and cornflakes and corn oil and high fructose corn syrup. And
right.
All of those uses, there is only about 8% of our crop. Ethanol, you know, if you look at it, is really helping to reduce the price of gas. At least it has, as is my understanding, nationwide. And the price of grain is a very supply demand oriented thing, and it's a world market. And Stephen understands this far better than I do. But we're continuing with the devalued dollar. We're continuing. We're working with the high price of oil. And those things really increase the price of transportation, distribution, mm-hmm. production, packaging, advertising, everything else, including
that's
the price
of
grain.
That's one of the unique things that is now is the cost of the planting this year because of the price of diesel and the other inputs have been, it's been a record expenditure in terms of planting this year because of the cost. Associated with it, so it's almost a double whammy here. Is that, you know, it's been very expensive to get the crops into the field, and the potential payout in terms of very high prices was made that investment seem worthwhile. But now with with the flooding, some of these farmers, the ones that did not have insurance, are going to be looking at making very difficult decisions,
such as what, getting out of farming,
perhaps getting out of farming.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to realize that a lot of the land that was flooded, was perhaps, with the price being as high as it is, farmers had a real incentive to go fence post to fence post,
mm-hmm.
and to plant into lands that maybe they normally wouldn't plant into. Now, I have not seen the data on that, but if I'm looking at $7.50 corn and $15 soybeans, I'm going to try to get as much land planted as I possibly can. Particularly, if I'm a dairy farmer and I'm looking at using this for feed, I'm going to try to, internalize as much cost as I possibly can. Now, how much of this floodland was put into marginal land, I'm not real sure. That's something that we're going to have to take a look-see and look back on.
And if you're in this business, are you thinking about next year? Are you thinking about a couple years hence and another major flood? Or are you thinking this is once in every 500 years, we're going to bet that it's not going to happen again?
Well, was it 1993 we had the 500-year flood and we were set and that was it. And,
right.
This one's broken the 93 flood.
So does it make you change your mind about whether or not you should be doing this at all or not?
I think it's going to really vary by farmer to farmer, particularly the makeup of their land. Are they in floodplain? How much of their land is in floodplain? How prone is their farm fields to flooding? And there are going to be a lot of farmers that are in these shallow lands, low-lying lands that are prone to flooding that are maybe going to decide, they need to do something differently. or at least not become dependent upon that particular piece of land that gets flooded.
Right.
Now, the problem is that we have the massive kind of flooding that Iowa's experienced and now working its way down the Mississippi. You know, some of those farmers, you know, the whole farm is in a potential floodplain. Those farmers are facing a very different decision than a farmer who has part of their land that's being flooded out.
Hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for our guests, and we'll take them in just one moment. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We're looking at the impact of the floods, the horrendous floods all over the Midwest, particularly hard hit in the state of Iowa, and figuring out how it's going to be affecting the farmers who live in our part of the country, and also how it affects the consumers, too, with an increased cost in fuel, an increased cost in food, and a global market that is where production hasn't kept up and is also forcing prices higher. So we're all affected by this. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who are farming and all the decisions that you have to make at this time. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us, joining us from our studios in Madison, Professor Stephen Deller, professor and community development economist in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us from Ames, Iowa at Iowa State University, Professor Roger Elmore, who is a professor and corn agronomist at the Department of Agronomy. We'll be with you in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Keith from Dubuque, our first caller. Hi, Keith.
Hello?
Yes, Keith, go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm listening to your program this morning, and it's a very good program. I'm not finding fault with it or anything, but we're talking about farmers and whatnot making decisions on whether or not they should replant. And the first thing that came to my mind was all of the television coverage and the newspaper articles that I have seen. That's not going to be a decision for some of these poor people because they don't even have a farm. I mean, the whole place is totally surrounded with water. You know, their equipment is shot. Some of these people probably don't even have a place to live.
I'm sure that's true.
And that I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention that you know, replanting is one thing, but some of these people just, I mean, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be lucky to have a place to sleep.
Yeah. Roger, you want to take that?
Oh, yes. That's a real issue. And, you know, I really, folks that have warm and dry or cool and dry houses are really blessed and fortunate. And people whose machine sheds and equipment was above the water lines are really fortunate as well. So you're right, Keith, no question there. You know, I've been fortunate that I didn't have any flood damage in my own house. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to handle calls like this all week. So I really understand what you're talking about. And the folks that are in those situations are worried about far more greater things than planting corn and soybeans at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Stephen, you want to respond to that too, please?
No, I think that's true, that there are going to be some farmers that are just devastated by this, that they simply have decided to perhaps walk away from it because of the fact that it's been so devastating that they simply cannot respond. But we also have to realize that, you know, in Wisconsin, we're looking at between 5% and 10% of the, you know, the cropland that has been damaged. When you look at Iowa and parts of Illinois, particularly western parts of Illinois, I mean, there the damage is much more widespread, particularly as it's related to agriculture. So I think, you know, depending on where we're looking in the Midwest, you know, the magnitude of the impacts are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And I know the president is in this area today. What response from the federal government here that's going to help everybody out? What are farmers looking for?
The one thing that they can be looking for is to make sure that there are emergency grants to help replenish damaged equipment, perhaps one-time grants to perhaps replace buildings that have been damaged and replace equipment. The one thing that the federal government can do is to be more aggressive in making sure that farmers are taking advantage of insurance programs and trying to minimize the risk that is out there, rather than coming back in after a disaster has happened and try to fix it, is to try to put into place as many insurance policies, if you will, or other programs that when something like this does happen, the farmer's got a plan in place. So they're not reacting to it, but rather they're being more in a position of, okay, I've planned for this, I have something in place, and I can. It's a disaster, but I've prepared for it.
Thanks very much for the call, Keith. Let's go to Nick next. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I'm a farmer from southern Wisconsin. Luckily, I don't have much land that flooded out. But one thing I'd like consumers to understand, and you know, we're dealing with high iron prices, high fuel prices, and right now there happens to be some sort of a shortage on fertilizers. And it's unfortunate at the time of high global food prices that this flood had to happen. But this is nature, and, you know, we get to deal with this all the time. And, you know, you got to roll with the punches. And once in a while, we, as farmers, still need that that government support to get us over these humps.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have any thoughts about leaving the profession as a result of all that's going on a worldwide basis, and particularly the floods of this year, Nick?
Well, these you know, we've had floods before. We had, you know, in 93 it flooded the Mississippi then, and in 88 it was extremely dry. You know, the weather does that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you need to keep a little extra hay in the barn to get you through them tough times, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think Nick raises a very good point. Farmers have been through this before, and we've had a number of shaking outs of farms that perhaps were in marginal land. You can look over in the Kickapoo Valley area, for example, which has a history of flooding. We've got Gaze Mills. We've got Soldiers Grove. Soldiers Grove actually picked up the town and moved it back in the 1970s because they were tired of being flooded out. Farmers that are in areas that are prone to flooding have experienced this before. And, you know, have they adequately prepared for this through insurance policies and having backup plans? I think the longer question, or the more viable question, is whether or not the sustained high prices, how is this going to ripple its way through? The flooding is just, you know, icing on the cake, if you will. But I don't think the flooding outside of Iowa, perhaps, is really going to be the driving factor. I think it's going to be these extremely high energy prices, extremely high feed prices, very high fertilizer prices. How are these things going to work their way through?
Mm-hmm. You want to respond to that, Roger?
I really don't have too much to add, but Nick brings up some valid points. You know, farming is a risky venture. It's also a business venture, but it's a super high risk. Farmers of all people understand the intricacies and complexities of the weather systems and all these events that happen. That's the way they live, and that's the way they breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a good wake-up call for the rest of us to see that.
Nick, thanks for the call. Kristen is next from Princeton. Hi, Kristen.
Yes, hi. Say, my question or comment, I think, dovetails right into Nick's comments, and that is that these farmers who lie in predominantly river valley beds, etc., I think move there and establish themselves there to take advantage of the rich nutrient soil. And that, you know, with that, I'm sure is an understanding that because they are in a riverbed area, that they run the risks of those areas being flooded. That's how the nutrients got there, you know, to begin with. And that if, you know, you have to look at it as a business model that, you know, I own a business and I'm tourist based. And if the sun is shining and the weather's good and hot, I get a lot of customers. If it's raining and cold, like it's been this spring, well, not so good. So I need to be flexible in my business model to understand the things that affect my business and take advantage when I can take advantage, but then, you know, have, like your guests have said, a backup plan when you know that that risk is out there. And that's my first comment. And then the other, and not that I, you know, don't have empathy with these folks, but I would think that, you know, that's an understanding they would need to have living in these areas or the nature of farming itself. And then my other comment would be that, you know, again, I think these things, the high price of fuel, regional natural or regional disasters like this, and high food prices underscore, I think, that we've gotten away from what we need to get back to, and that's a local agrarian economy that we rely more locally than we do nationally or internationally on some of these products that are basics for our life.
Stephen, you want to take that?
That's a fascinating question, and that's something that I want to actually look at later on as the season plays itself out. But a lot of these smaller, not necessarily organic farmers, but more community-based agriculture, if you will, a lot of these types of operations are tend to be located in these more marginal types of lands because they're smaller scale. They're you know, farmers can get into these types of operations. They're not quite as land intensive as, say, some of the, you know, the corn and bean farms in Illinois and Iowa. Now, this is the question that I have, is how many of these smaller community-based farms are actually more at risk to things like flooding because of where they're physically located? That's something that, you know, we won't be able to answer until, you know, the season kind of plays its way out. But community-based agriculture is, I think, something that will be growing and will become more important, particularly in the more urban areas like the Madisons and perhaps the Chicagos. But it's a very small piece of the agricultural pie. It can it be viable for, is it a viable business model for some folks? Yes, it is, very much so. I'll have to admit, when organic came out a number of years ago, I thought it was going to be a very thin market, and there weren't going to be that many people willing to pay a dollar premium on milk to buy organic. Well, I was wrong. So it's time's going to, you know, it's going to play out. The other thing is, you know, now with gasoline as high as it is, are people going to start cutting back and perhaps not be willing to pay the premium for organic or community-based agriculture, and just say, when gasoline was $2 a gallon, I could afford to pay that extra amount of money for organic or community-based agriculture. But now at $4 plus a gallon, I got to cut back somewhere, and I'm going to cut back on community-supported agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen some news reports over the last week that indeed is happening right now. People are cutting back on that.
Well, they are. I mean, if you go to the grocery store and you're looking at $3, I don't buy the groceries, my wife does, so don't quote me if I'm wrong on the prices here, but if you're looking at $3 a gallon regular milk versus $4 a gallon organic milk, and you just put $60 to fill up your car, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Time will tell.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Kristen. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That is talk@wpr.org. We're looking at the recent floods in the Midwest and the effect that these horrendous floods are having on the agriculture industry in our part of the country. And, you know, you combine the floods with the increasing cost of fuel and what's going on worldwide with food prices, and it's a very, very difficult situation for farmers in our state, in Iowa, and certainly in the Midwest. We have two guests with us this hour, Stephen Deller, who's professor and community development economist at the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us by from our studios in Madison, and Roger Elmore, professor and extension corn agronomist, Department of Agronomy at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Lines are open for you right now, and we'd like very much to hear from you. Somebody mentioned just a little while ago, gentlemen, this being able to be flexible in your business model. It strikes me that that might be incredibly difficult right now because everything's tied together. So the cost of fuel for running your farm has just skyrocketed, and now you've got the floods. How can you be flexible here? What can you look at that's something different for you so you can survive?
And I'll let Roger handle kind of the science side of it, but okay. In terms of the economics of it, it's simply trying to perhaps form partnerships with neighboring farms for sharing of equipment, for custom contracting out, for trying to coordinate as best as you can in terms of marketing and input supplies, the use of cooperatives, for example, in terms of purchasing insurance, going into the futures markets. I'm not suggesting that farmers go into the futures markets individually, but perhaps as within the form of a co-op through a marketing co-op. There's lots on the business side that farmers can do to be a little bit more innovative, if you will. And a lot of farmers are very successful at doing that. But in terms of the science side, I'll let Roger handle
that. Roger?
Yeah, for short term, and I assume we're talking short term kinds of issues here, flexibility, and those are the issues that we talk about quite a bit. And so what are our options? Replanting corn, replanting soybeans are still options, and people are looking at various spreadsheets to figure out the various cost-benefit ratios there, and is this really a profitable thing given the yield reductions that might be up to half on both crops? Then we've got all the potential forages, and you know, there are livestock operations around. There's a lot of summer annuals that can be planted, forage sorghums and millets, and corn too, cut for silage. And of course, the last option now is, the last one I'll talk about is the crop insurance thing. And at least our economists, and Stephen, I assume you guys over there also have a whole bevy of spreadsheets that help people think through these options. You know, I provide information on yields and hybrids to grow and so forth, and our soil fertility people suggest ideas on nitrogen and on and on. And then the farmers themselves put these numbers into spreadsheets and look at the bottom line. You know, farming's a business.
I think one thing that has changed over the last 30 years is that the farmers, there's been a number of shakeouts in agriculture, and you know, the farmers that have been able to survive, I'm impressed by their savvy. Many of them are ahead of the curve and are actually doing quite well in terms of, you know, planning and being prepared and being able to roll with the punches as they come.
All right, let's go to Brad from Fountain, Minnesota. Hi, Brad.
Hi. My question was, we were thinking about all this water that's running off and all this flooding. And with all the corn and bean fields, you know, without any vegetation, how much that plays as a factor or a role into this excess water that doesn't get slowed down, and then you get even more flooding because of that. You know, and anybody that's in these bottom grounds that would normally be the first to flood anyways, they get even more water coming through at a faster rate.
That makes sense. May I respond to that first, Kathleen?
Of course.
You know, the one of the things that's changed in my career of who knows how long now, but it's been two or three decades here, is the increase in amount of soil and no tillage and reduced tillage operations. And what that has done for us, in a sense, and there's various things that have allowed that to happen, equipment and herbicides and on, but what that means then, that if we would have had these kinds of floods back 30 years ago, the amount of erosion and soil loss from most of our fields would just be magnified multifold relative to what we have now because of the residue that's on there. But Brad, I think your point goes further than that in saying that once you wash all those corn stalks down into the baseball fields of the small towns around us, that that ground is barren then and more susceptible to erosion, and that's exactly right. There's not much we can do for it, but I would still argue that we are better off now than we would have been three decades ago.
Well, I do agree, you know, the practices have made huge improvements, but at the same time, you know, and it's everybody chasing this dollar, you know, these seven, I don't know, I heard corn was $8, $9 now on Chicago this morning.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, so now everybody, they're seeing that, you know, and they're looking at this huge pot of gold in the fall if it happened. And, you know, so pastures, you know, fields, pastures that were cropped, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago and been put into pasture because they're lower production, you know, they're going back in and they're ripping all those up and planting corn this year, you know, and chasing it, you know. And so I guess, you know, it's, even though the practices are good, they're still going in, busting up this old sod that did help filter and slow down this water, you know. And we just keep adding more acres every year, and we're losing the vegetative, you know. I mean, I'm not going to tell you that sod base, you know, the water won't run off of that either, but it dramatically slows it down.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Roger, maybe you've seen the numbers on these, but one of the concerns that we've had is the amount of land that's being taken out of conservation reserve.
Mm-hmm.
This is marginal land that was put along stream banks and whatnot for environmental reasons, also to kind of keep the crop production down a little bit. Is, you know, at these prices, it does not make sense to keep land in conservation reserve. And I'm not sure how much has been taken out, but it's a very large number, and it goes directly to Brad's comment that a lot of this land that was in conservation reserve was marginal, it was environmentally sensitive, and well, now it's got corn and beans on it.
Yeah, that's true. I think the only handle I can get on that, Stephen and Brad, is if I look at, and you're both right, the CRP ground had taken pastures out. In our March 31st report from the USDA, I think there's about a couple hundred thousand acres in Iowa that seem to move from somewhere to somewhere. And all I can figure is that's some of the CRP and that's some of the hay ground that's going into either corn or soybean. So that's real, and it concerns me as well. I would hope that if that kind of soil, those kinds of fields are broken up, that very good reduced tillage or no-tillage practices are used there to prevent even worse problems than otherwise.
Thanks very much for the call, Brad. We have an email. Considering the extensive damage, I was wondering if many of the small farmers will be forced out. And if so, do you think they'll be bought out by more corporate farms versus smaller farms? Thanks, Greg.
It depends. It depends really on where the farms are located. If they're small farms that tend to be in floodplained areas, that land is probably not going to stay in agriculture very long. If you go into southwestern Wisconsin, into the Driftless area, a lot of that land that was marginal agricultural land is now going into recreation. And if I was a farmer and I was, you know, constantly being flooded out or risked of being flooded out, and I've got a small operation to begin with, and I could sell it to some folks from Chicago for, you know, 3-4 times the price, I think you're going to see conversion out. And that's happening to a large extent in southwestern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Roger, do you agree?
Yeah, I really can't add too much. I'm, you know, farming is a business, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what will pencil out. I think Stephen's got the best answer.
Let's welcome more phone calls for our guests. Here's the number for you to join us. Our guests are Stephen Deller, professor and community development economist in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us from our studios in Madison. Roger Elmore is joining us from Ames, Iowa, Iowa State University, where he is professor and extension corn agronomist in the Department of Agronomy at that university. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, our Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, the email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, after the news from National Public Radio at 10 o'clock, we'll be talking about the legalization of gay marriage in the state of California. Our phone number, as we look at the floods in the Midwest, the corn prices at the Chicago Board of Trade at an all-time high, the high cost of fuel, which makes it so much more expensive for farmers to do business, the worldwide demand, and we'll bring that part of the conversation in here in just a moment, and whether or not people will be leaving the business, how in the world do you recover from the massive floods that we've had the past couple weeks in Wisconsin, in Iowa, in parts of Missouri and Illinois? Let's go to Maggie from Appleton for our next caller, gentlemen. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I wanted to point out to your economist that with the CSA agriculture, because it is community supported, people have an investment. We have an investment in our food. We're not going to give that up. We're not going to give up our organic food. What we're going to do is we're going to give up going to the movies or buying that new car or doing those things. So I think the economic impact is different. We've belonged to a CSA for 20 years, and they were flooded out. And people from all over northeastern Wisconsin came in to help them clean up, replant, put things back in the ground, because we understand that this is our food source. So your economist was talking about how the CSAs were probably going to go down. I think it's the bigger agriculture that is going to have the bigger impact. The smaller farms have a different support mechanism, unlike the larger farms. You know, you don't see people coming out to the big farms and helping people replant.
Maggie, I wish everybody was as passionate about their food source as you are. Unfortunately, there's not as many folks out there like Maggie as perhaps there should be. When folks start looking at the price of food and the price of energy and whatnot, they're going to start making some tough decisions. And unfortunately, you know, food could be, you know, with high prices of food the way they are right now, people are going to be making some lower cost alternative decisions, particularly as they're going into a recession. Is this going to be the death of community-based agriculture? No, I don't think so. But it may have hit a plateau for a while. It had seen tremendous growth and was a very positive thing, because it can be a very good thing for a community, not only from an economic development perspective, but from a community development perspective. You know, people coming together to help the farm rebuild after flooding is a great example of a dynamic community. And I think that those will continue, but I there's been a bit of a plateauing there, and I think it's being driven a lot by prices.
What a nice thing, though. It's a nice image you've presented for us, Maggie, of people very concerned about what they eat and
right. And
helping out. That's good. Thanks, Maggie, for your call.
Thank you.
Catherine from Appleton. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Steve. This is Catherine Nicewinder. Hey.
Hello there.
I wanted to ask you guys to comment maybe on some of the more positive trends that are happening that might be affecting this. And that's the trend towards looking at sustainability, and maybe this goes a little bit to what you commented on with the previous phone caller, not just towards energy, but agriculture, the way we live our lives. There's a large positive trend in this direction, and I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think that, again, this is going to play itself out. I think that people are starting to react now to gasoline prices. I had a lot of folks were asking me, you know, when are people going to change their commuting patterns with the price of gasoline? Well, we could never estimate that, because prices never got that far out of this normal range. Well, now it seems to be at $4, seems to be the magic number. At what point are we going to hit that with food? We're not quite sure. But I think that there is a movement afoot for people to be more sensitive about where their food is coming from. And I think that, the evidence of coming out from this flooding, of going fence post to fence post, of taking land out of conservation reserve, I think that there's going to be a broader policy discussion about this. And I think that's a very positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Can we move to a world perspective here for a moment, Roger? We've been reading about worldwide food prices going up. I mean, it's hard to fathom this. 83% in the past 3 years, according to the World Bank. Bad weather in major grain-producing regions is part of the reason. That's got to force prices up here higher as well, doesn't it?
There's no question that we're in a world economy. But just look at the grocery store shelves in terms of, where do the strawberries come from in January, for instance? And so it's just a small idea of what consumers can see. That's even more real in the commodity prices of corn. You know, if we have a corn a reduction in corn acres and production in the United States, like it sounds like we will this year, guess what's going to happen? The Argentines, the Brazilians, the South Africans are going to be increasing their production of corn. The Chinese will be doing that as well. Of course, they're on the same cycle we are. But in the Southern Hemisphere, there's going to be a gigantic increase in feed grain production there.
And unfortunately, a lot of that's going to be coming at the expense of cutting down rainforest and more forested areas.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of ground in places like Argentina that are what we call the plains, you know, like the plains I'm living on, and short grass prairies, tall grass prairies, kind of ground that is not in rainforest that would be developed and is virtually growing something else at this point, too. You know, so it's just I think the economists, at least in Iowa, even call it, corn is buying so many acres, or soybeans are buying acres. So it's not necessarily rainforest for corn or rainforest for soybeans. It's grain sorghum for corn, or it's wheat for corn, or maybe it's pasture for corn.
Michelle from Sauk County. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to lend some perspective from what's going on in Sauk County here, one of the hardest hit counties in Wisconsin. We're seeing weather damage that we've never seen before, and areas of our county that have historically never had flooding have flooded. And while we have flooding in areas of the Midwest where it's been typical, it's not here. We use conservation tillage on our farm. We use a lot of the practices necessary, like grass waterways, to keep soil intact. But we're looking at huge gorges and gullies ripped through our farm fields. Our pasture, which is, of course, sod, is full of boulders. We can't even get our cattle into it. Mm-hmm. And I want consumers to understand that farmers are probably the most adaptable people in the business place because we're always gambling with the weather. But you can't just go into a 40-acre farm field with 8-foot gullies in it and fix it by tomorrow and be able to replant once it's been drained of the floodwaters. So this isn't a case where we have people continually farming in areas that really aren't suitable for crop production. We have a lot of people who are using techniques to, you know, make best use of the land, but this is unprecedented. And I get frustrated with the caller who, you know, suggested that we need to be more adaptable and rethink our business model. And when you're dealing with the land and nature, you have a lot more constraints than a machine sitting in a factory that could be retooled to make new product.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, I think, that consumers are willing to continue to pay inflated prices for movie theater tickets, clothing, all sorts of consumable goods that are not basic needs. But as soon as food prices go up in the store, they talk about changing their food buying habits and reducing what they spend at the grocery store, but they're still going to go through the drive-through and buy fast food and buy a lot of necessities. So I wanted to lend that point as well, and then ask the economist to explain to people that for small-scale livestock farms, help them understand how if we see $14 corn, they're not going to be able to afford to run that value of feed through an animal to sell a meat or a dairy product.
Excellent points. Thank you.
That's a very good point.
You
know, could I add, too, that
Michelle
is right on in terms of, you know, most of the farmers I know have been attempting to increase sustainable production practices for the last two to three decades. And we're doing far better now than we ever have before. And that's not only small farms, but large farms as well. We have access to the same technology, and it's really improved the way we handle the environment.
I think one thing that Wisconsin farmers could be very proud of is the fact that they've been at the forefront historically at using environmentally friendly conservation techniques and planting technique and harvesting techniques. And I think that the typical Wisconsin farmer can really be quite proud of their environmental consciousness. You know, how this all plays out in terms of food, it's really, you know, time will tell. But with energy prices the way that they are, I mean, we're in uncharted waters. We have never seen energy prices this high, and we have not really seen food prices this high in a very, very long time. So, you know, it goes back to my question, you know, when are people going to change their commuting patterns based on gasoline? Well, you know, In hindsight, we know it's about $4 a gallon. When are people going to change their food purchasing patterns? Time will tell. Yeah. If I knew the answer to that, I'd be filthy rich on Wall Street.
Right. Well, times are rough. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being with us. We appreciate it. I'm sure you're pretty busy guys this week. Our guests, Stephen Deller, professor and community development economist, Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, joining us from our studios in Madison, and Roger Elmore, a professor and extension corn agronomist from the Department of Agronomy at Iowa State University in Ames. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production. And thanks, as always, for the wonderful calls that come through and give us a much better understanding of what's happening in and about the Midwest here as we deal with these record floods. News coming up will return. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.